and welcome to Saturday Supercast, episode 10. This week we have a conversation with my buddy Hoover, as well as Sean Robert of BrandonInThe80s.com. We talk a little bit about the revival of 80s cartoon properties, which evolves into a general discussion of the role of nostalgia in modern media. Believe it or not, this actually has something to do with Sugary Cereals comics. Enjoy!
Head for Sugary Cereals, you know I'm right behind you. Flying through the air, Sugary Cereals are better. Me and Boxer know just where.
So thank goodness for Super Walmart being open 24/7.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If I couldn't shop, I'd have to totally amend my entire life.
Speaking of shopping.
Uh-oh, segue.
Tributary. No. I'm heading into the topic with this. Who of us here has gotten the new 25th anniversary G.I. Joe figures? Like the new...
I'm raising my hand.
My hand is down because I can't find Wave 3 yet.
Have you seen him, Sean?
I found a Shipwreck. And that's it. I found a Shipwreck and a Stalker. But not the Firefly and Zartan that I wanted.
Big surprise. That's going to be what's going to happen when anyone looks for Wave 3. It's going to be like, oh, Shipwreck, hello, where's the rest? Oh, they've sold. Strange, the sailor guy with the beard didn't sell. But strangely, Firefly and Zartan and the Red Ninja sold. Big surprise.
Yeah, Red Ninja.
Way to go, Hasbro.
Yeah, really. Hoover, you have a problem with bearded men, though. I mean, that was your chief complaint about the Visionaries, was that they're all bearded
Well,
men.
They're not fun for kids to play with. Kids don't go, you know what? I wish I had an action figure of a bearded man to play with. No. They go, I want a Red Ninja to play with, or I want this guy who changes color in the sunlight to play with, or I want this gray camouflage ninja-looking dude to play with.
But what about the 1960s? What about the 1960s with G.I. Joe where he had a real beard?
Well, in the 1960s, that's when they did ask for beards.
Yeah.
But they
the
stopped doing that eventually. I think around 1978, all requests for beards stopped. And no one told the producers of the Visionaries toy line this, unfortunately.
Didn't half of the original G.I. Joe line have beards?
Yeah, they did.
Were they all like Rock and Roll or Breaker?
Wait a minute, you're right. A lot of the original Joes did have beards. And then later on it was mustaches. It was like Rotondo and Mutt and...
Yeah, see, they had to slowly wean themselves off the facial hair. They couldn't just go cold turkey. It was like, okay, we'll just do mustaches for a couple dudes, and then we'll be done.
Well,
exactly. We moved from Josh Brolin's dad to Tom Selleck, so...
That's true. That's our pop culture reference guy for us.
Yep.
So.
Well, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Tom Selleck is like the only man ever who looks great with a mustache.
And freaky without.
Yes. Well, wait a minute. Let me take that back. Tom Selleck and Hulk Hogan are like the only two guys who can wear mustaches and it looks great.
Are you sure you want to be talking about your love of dudes with mustaches on this podcast? Is that what the theme is?
Well, I'm just thinking about how, you know how like mustaches are kind of like cool again right now? The ironic mustache. And everybody just looks like...
Oh, yeah.
And everybody just looks like Steve Buscemi. They just look kind of creepy and weird with those mustaches. And he looks like Tom Selleck, and he looks great.
All I know is it's a good thing that Carter had a big chrome mask on, because I'm sure he was fully bearded under that being developed when he was.
Okay, minor tributary. Let's talk about Cobra and mustaches. The Rock Viper comes out, the Rock Viper from 1988 or 89, and
that's
the first time we get a Cobra who we see the bottom half of his face, what does he have? A mustache.
Yeah. Well, that's because those guys had to climb mountains and it got cold up there. And they see Cobra Commander was too cheap to issue chapstick, so they had to keep those lips warm somehow. That's my backstory anyway.
That's the fanfic that you wrote, which you can find at Hoover's website.
Which is not true, but hypothetically.
What was the title of that? My Kingdom for an Arelco?
It is now.
I noticed also that all the Cobra troops that they're releasing, you can take their helmets off and they're all bald. So
yeah,
maybe they had mustaches
strange
to make up for it, because Cobra Commander wanted those helmets to be form-fitting. So.
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking too much about hair. I do want to bring this thing onto the topic of the discussion for today.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, what are we talking about, Sean? Do you wanna put forth today's topic?
Sure. Well, I was listening to Art and Story number 10 that you and Mark did, and you were talking about how you process your influences into your work, or looking at the influences that influenced your work that are outside of comics. And I was just thinking about in general. For myself, like I'm so, you know, you were talking about how you keep going back to cartoons and stuff, and I keep going back to this chunk of 80s nostalgia, and I'm looking at pop culture today, and it seems like it's amazingly influenced by 80s nostalgia, but differently than I think generations before have processed their influences, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's, instead of being influenced by something, internalizing it, and turning it into something new, there's a lot more rehashing going on, or a lot more just, let's just go back to that thing in the 80s and celebrate that again. And I was kind of curious, is this something that, you know, is this generation, or has this been going on before and I just haven't realized it because I'm not hip to older generations' influences?
Well, actually, I don't know if we talked about this before or not, or maybe I talked about this on Art and Story. I can't remember, but I seem to remember having the conversation that in the 70s, Happy Days came out, you know, and George Lucas did American Graffiti, which was like a celebration of his youthful time, and it brought back this kind of 50s nostalgia. And so I wonder if it's like a 20-year thing. Like once the people who grew up in that era get into their 30s and they're making media, they're looking back wistfully on their youthful years, right? Like, the Wonder Years came out in the 80s, and that was a tribute to the 60s,
okay,
and growing up in that time. So it just makes me wonder if that's what's at play here. And, yeah, there's always going to be stuff that's more creatively done and stuff that's less creatively done, where it seems like almost a cash grab. Like, oh, these kids, they really like – like, you get two things going on, it seems like to me. You got the guys our age who are looking back wistfully and nostalgically – and then you got the kids growing up now who are like, oh, this 80s stuff was bizarre. Why did everybody, you know, have their hair all huge and wear glitter all over everything, and everything was pink, and they had palm trees and blazers with T-shirts underneath? So it's like a fascination with it because it's so weird to them. It's so, you know, out of their experience. So this kind of comes
I would definitely say that nostalgia is definitely on a 20-year cycle. But he's specifically saying, like, why is the stuff that's coming out today of the 80s nostalgia, why is it almost like carbon copies of what we had back then rather than just influence? Like, it's not like there was a Happy Day series in the 50s that they brought back in the 70s. It's like they just sort of created something new back then. But today, a lot of the quote-unquote nostalgic stuff is basically the old stuff done better. I mean, just look at the He-Man toy line from 2002, the Masters of the Universe toy line. You look at the G.I. Joe 25th anniversary toy line. Heck, you look at the new Transformers today and how they're consistently a lot of the same characters. It's just the same thing, just done better. The question I think that Sean was posing is, why is that? And my first answer is that the 80s was just such a creative time that I think a lot of the concepts were strong enough to stick around. Whereas if you look at the toys from the 70s, a lot of them seem to be based more on concept than execution. Like you had toys like Stretch Armstrong. Wow, he stretches. You know, that was more of a technology thing. It's like, look what we can do with toys now. And you had, you had all sorts of stuff come out in the 70s. And I think the 70s was sort of the genesis of a lot of stuff we got in the 80s. But by the time the 80s came along, it was pretty well refined. And I think because it wasn't until the 80s that you could actually you know, have cartoons that basically advertised toys, that a lot of the toy lines sort of got stronger in that decade because it could have more depth and more meaning, a la, you know, a TV tie-in.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 70s, you sort of had to exist on your own without anything else. And I, you know, I think that's a large part of it. That's surely not the be-all, end-all reason.
Well, I was just wondering, as you're talking about this, if this isn't something where maybe the reason that it a lot of that stuff resonates so easily is like the 80s stuff in particular. And maybe I'm talking out of turn because I'm only speaking from my own experience. I can't talk for somebody who grew up in the 70s. I'd have to ask, like, my older brother or something, like, what that would be like. But it seems like when you watch, like, the old-timey G.I. Joe commercials from the 60s and 70s, it was about role-playing, but it had very little to do with characters. It was very plot-driven. Like, we got to get the shark out of the water. We got to save the guy from the cave. we got to stop the tiger. It was very little about this guy's different from that guy, and let's act out the characters. Whereas in the 80s, because we had those cartoons, it was kind of like, it was like as Sean said, it was a great jumping off point. They gave us essentially the starter kit. But here's how to get your imagination activated, so now you can role play through all these different characters, and it's still about plot too, but it's also about which guy do you want to be. Whereas in the old Joes, it was like, well, do you want to be the bearded one or the not bearded one?
Yeah. And I think as far as G.I. Joe goes, that sort of started in the 70s with the Adventure Team, where you had guys like Bullet Man who basically just had a really good helmet and could fly through the air. And I don't remember who else was on the 70s line, but basically that's when the individual characters sort of started. And they were a little stranger than we're used to, but that got sort of refined from the 1982 line and a more militaristic approach, and voila.
I want to hear
Sean's thoughts. I would definitely agree with you on that point.
I want to hear Sean's thoughts on this, but I also want to dog-ear this for future discussion, is that something else I've noticed about that era is that because there were a lot of comic book writers on board with these projects in the 80s, I detect, and maybe this is me reading into it too much, but I detect a definite superhero influence on especially on G.I. Joe and Transformers, where you have guys who they essentially have their own special ability, and it's like primary military specialty. Okay, that's fine. But also in Transformers, you had like, here's Ironhide, he can shoot chemicals out of his hands. Here's Windcharger, he's got a magnetic field thing he can do. Here's a Trailbreaker, he has a force field. Everybody had their own kind of quote unquote superpower, and in the Joes also equally, you had each guy had his own special thing that only he could do, and that was kind of like how you look at things like Fantastic Four, Justice League. Exactly the same thing. Here's the Flash, he runs fast. Here's Hawkman, he flies. So I'm wondering if part of that was what made it so powerful is the fact that it was the merging of two, up to that point, disparate philosophies of marketing. So, but now I'd like to give Sean a chance to take the floor on this.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you guys talking about that, it makes me think of comic books and how it's kind of funny that DC and Marvel seem to have, you know, I mean, I know they've been creating characters forever, but at the end of the day, they have their two big groups of characters that each of them created very early on, and they've just stuck around since. And I guess, in a way, the 80s pop culture stuff, the cartoons and all that, they hit that same note or something, where they've, I don't know, like they made those dynamic characters or those, you know, well, I guess I'm just really repeating some stuff you both guys said, but it's funny how they sort of echo each other. Because you know, I've always looked at comics like that, and I've always wondered, you know, why does Spider-Man stick around? Or, like, to take it even further away, I think I've probably brought this up before, but why do kids today still react the way they do to Mickey Mouse when he's not really in pop culture the way he was in the 30s, 40s, and 50s? Mm-hmm. Yet any kid today can look at Mickey Mouse and tell you exactly who that is and what he's like. And
well, I think that comes down to the power of the cartoon, doesn't it? Where we're talking about like a simplification. I shouldn't say this, a distillation of detail into a, you know, a little set of lines that evoke like that's the whole. I mean, we're getting to like the heart of the philosophy behind sugary cereals in general is distilling down an idea through the power of the cartoon. And by cartoon, I mean the actual drawing cartoon, not an animated cartoon, but evoking a lot of information with very, very little. Work or you know, little detail, right?
Yeah.
Cheap plug.
No, this is a Saturday Supercast, dude. We're supposed to be talking about sugary cereals.
I know, I'm just joking.
It's not like we're on Market Watch, NBC, you know.
That's much like my website. Yeah, I agree. I know, I'm just giving you a hard time.
Well, we could mention that this kind of stuff is also talked about on BrandedInThe80s.com, which
true.
Is God's site.
So you're going to have to wade through a 6 million Halloween posts to get to that.
I'm waiting for the Thanksgiving post. So I want to read about turkey and dressing.
Yeah, 30 days of Thanksgiving. What in the world would you post about for 30 days about Thanksgiving besides, I mean, what is it? It's like gluttony, watching football, and not liking watching football.
I guess you could do 30 years worth of Macy's Thanksgiving Day parades.
Oh, there you go.
You can do an in-depth study of tryptophan and how it makes you sleepy when you eat turkey. And
yeah.
I don't know. I think there's something to be mined here.
there's a buck to be made. I also think to get to the kind of like crass marketing aspect of why we're seeing essentially a rehashing of a lot of stuff is trademarks. You know, Duke, Optimus Prime, Bumblebee, those are trademarks that Hasbro wants to hang on to. So if they're going to make new G.I. Joe lines and new Transformers lines, it's in their best interest to keep remaking characters so they can hang on to the trademarks. Look at what happened with things like Hawk, how he had to become General Tomahawk. And which by the way, I was looking at some of those core figures in the store the other day, and one of the characters is named Hawk, which makes me wonder, they're the guys who got it?
I think that is what happened. And if you look on the upcoming 25th anniversary 2-pack that has Hawk and Scarlet in it, they call him G.I. Joe Hawk. Apparently those core guys were sneaky and actually got the name.
Wow, that's so crazy that like the line of figures that we all sneer at is the pretend G.I. Joes. They got the trademark on Hawk now.
Yeah, you know the day that happened, the guys at Lanard, the makers of Core, were like, yeah, high five, we stole a G.I. Joe name.
So, I don't know, was there any place else we wanted to head with this thing?
I just think that the concepts that were created in the 80s just, you know, for the most part, happened to be strong enough to warrant a return. I think if anything is good enough, it should be brought back. Because, I mean, what's the fairness, like, let's say if G.I. Joe had never come back in 1982, what if you were, like, all into, like, military stuff as a kid? And, I mean, you deserve to have a little military toy to play with. I mean, that's sort of silly. And what if you're all into, like, goofy-looking, beastie-type guys who are all buff and stuff? But, you know, He-Man ended in 1991. Well, let's bring him back for the new generation. I mean, that's the great thing about, generations, is that it's new to them. You know, as far as the kids who were, you know, 7 years old in 2002, they weren't alive for the original He-Man line. So you could basically do the same stuff as Mattel, and it would be totally new to these kids. So why not save all that money on research and development and just do what you've already done? I mean, that's sort of the dream answer for a company. Like, what can I do to make lots of money that I don't have to spend lots of money on? Well, if you have this toy line that's been sitting in dust since the early 90s and those kids were only born in the early 90s, well, let's bring that out again. And maybe we'll amp it up a little bit so the older collectors will want to get them all over again.
Can I pose a philosophical question to you both?
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll pose it to Sean then. You can just keep your mouth shut for a minute.
Oh, okay.
Do you think that we would be better off if whether or not they bring it back is out of the question? I mean, let's stipulate that they're going to bring the stuff back no matter what. So He-Man's going to come back, Transformers going to come back, G.I. Joe's going to come back. Do you think that the culture at large and the property itself would be best served if they reinvented by taking what worked about it in the first place and just update it for a new generation, or if they bring it back wholesale. Which do you think is better, or are both have their pros and cons? Sean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Like, for instance, the Transformers movie, which I still have not seen because it's clearly not my Transformers anymore.
Yeah.
They alienated me, but have they reached into a new audience with it because of that?
Yeah, I think there's two halves for that. I mean, I think for, parents who are raising new kids that weren't around the first time for this stuff, I think it's probably great for the kids because in a way it's almost like they're getting something that's their own, that's not just something that's rehashed. So when they get a little bit older and they realize maybe that this stuff was around before, that they don't feel sort of cheated. Like, well, I don't know if they'd feel cheated, but it would feel more like it was theirs. Like we feel with our G.I. Joes, because there were G.I. Joes before the 80s, and, I feel that mine were completely different, and it's a different thing. It's my thing. So I think for kids, I think that's a great thing. I think for everyone else in the older contingent, no. So I guess I'm torn, because I guess at the end of the day, if all this stuff boils down to entertainment, I don't get entertained as much by things that seem like they're twisted or rehashed or, I don't know, like the Transformers movie. I unfortunately did go see the Transformers movie, and it held almost no entertainment value for me whatsoever. And I think a lot of that probably has to do for my nostalgia for the original stuff. But at the same time, I had a hard time grasping on to modernizing it, because it's not just that they modernized it for what technology can do, but they changed the characters into more and more modern characters, and so it's like I feel like I'm torn here. It's like it's just not the same thing, yet it is the same thing, so I almost feel like it's playing on me, or it's like it's taking advantage of me.
I see, like they're playing on your nostalgia strings to get you to come to the table to watch something that you normally wouldn't watch.
Yeah, so it stops becoming entertainment. It starts becoming like I see the marketing too much behind it. So it's not as much of an enjoyable experience,
which is weird
because I'll sit down. I'll say real quick, I'll sit down and watch the new cartoons that come out, and I think a lot of times it's because it's still aimed at kids and it's got more of a not necessarily a wholesomeness to it, but it's more deceptively greedy that it doesn't affect me as much. So, like, when the new He-Man came out in 2002, even though it was completely different from what the original stuff was, it didn't bother me as much because it didn't seem as devious.
Well, but, Larry DiTilio wrote it, though. I mean, I think that had a lot to do with it, is that the guy who basically kind of developed the line in the first place for the cartoons came back to update it, so he was invested,
Yeah.
I mean, this happens too often where a new guy comes in. One of the things I've often said to Hoover in private conversation, and I'm putting it out there for the public because I want, animation companies to hear me, is I would love to get my hands on current licensed properties for animation, like to write it, because my first mission would be to do a ton of research and figure out what makes this toy line tick, what makes this communicate to the kids, why are they so into this? And then I'd write to that. I wouldn't come in and go, well, this Pokemon stuff is cute, but, I really think there should be bloody murder left and right, because that's the way I would do it. I think what happens too often is a writer comes in, it seems this way to me, is a writer comes in and says, this is all nice, this is all well and good, but really, I'm going to put my stamp on this thing. This is going to be, the Michael Bay Transformers, not the Transformers anymore. That's the way it feels. I could be wrong. I don't know what Michael Bay's thinking, but... But another reason, like something else I said about the Transformers movie I told Hoover is, the reason I couldn't see it is because it'd be like watching an ex-girlfriend that you still really, really, really love date a guy who beats her. It'd be too painful to sit through for me because I really, really love Transformers, and to watch it just get like raked over the coals by somebody who doesn't understand the concept or why the concept works. It'd be too awful to see. Now, I mean, I bet I would be able to watch the movie if... even with the current looks for everything, if they just would have kept the characters consistent with the original ideas of the characters.
Yeah. Well, like you were saying, like, playing to what makes something tick, I think that's definitely something that was lacking in the Transformers movies. They really didn't... I mean, the fact that these were transforming robots was beyond a secondary point. It was beyond tertiary. It really had nothing to do with what was going on with the movie, which is weird because it's what the movie's about. So they really did miss the mark on that. So I think you have definitely a valid point there.
And that I've talked with friends who have seen it, and they pretty much confirmed all my fears about the film. This happened with even when they did movies like the Masters of the Universe movie with Dolph Lundgren, they
groan.
Yeah, I mean, like really, I tell everybody it's the Frank Langella parts are worth watching. Skeletor is great, but everything else doesn't feel like He-Man anymore. It's because they think that they have to abandon what makes it tick in the first place to make it reach a wider audience or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it always kind of comes across to me. I want to make sure that I preface it with that to make sure that it's not like I'm saying anything definitive. I don't know what these guys are thinking, but it certainly looks like that.
Well, I know what they're thinking, and they're thinking, what is Hoover like about this? Let's take all that stuff out.
He doesn't have any money.
I think Sean brings up a good point. If you look at the 2002 Masters of the Universe toy line, some things about it were different than the original. Very few things, but some things were keenly different. And I include the cartoon in that as well. But if you look at, say, for example, the Masters of the Universe movie and compare it to the original toy line, if you look at the current Transformers movie and compare it to the original toy line, a lot of things are different. Yeah. And I think there's a subtle line to walk. If you're going to update a property, you can't go too far, or you've just wandered into a weird zone where it's not even really like the source material anymore. And if you're going to abandon so much of the source material like that, why don't you just be creative and write something original?
Well,
because
then
what becomes the point of obtaining this license and paying millions and millions of dollars for it if you're just going to deviate from the subject matter so much?
Devil's advocate is they would say, well, the reason we get the licensing is to get the guys like Sean to come. And plus it's got the brand recognition, too. I mean, how many people from our generation who forgot completely about the Transformers were like, oh, yeah, I remember that. Grimlock, he ruled. Woo! And then they went to the movie. And then these are the guys who came out and said, like, man, that movie rocked. It was for me. It was for my generation. It was older. It wasn't dumb, like, for kids. Right? So
I
heard that from so many people where I heard a terrible conversation in a comic store where the guys were just, blankety blank this and blankety blank that, and Transformers is blankety blank and awesome because it's for blankety blank and me because everybody says blankety blank. and Bumblebee peas, woo! So, I mean, they never meant to make the movie for us. They meant to make a movie for everybody, and they just used that licensing aspect to rope in as wide an audience as possible. So then they're just playing the nostalgia card. And this is kind of like, to go back to like what the philosophy of Sugary Cereals is that's only one of the cards we're playing with this. It's like we're playing this nostalgia card, but also it comes back to what I was saying about, like, if I got a licensed property, what would I do? I would pull apart what makes the property tick, and I'd find out what the beating heart of it is, and I would write to that. And that's what, Sean, you were referring to that art and story episode I did with Mark, and that's what we were talking about, is like what inspires you, what informs your work is when you take an idea and rip off all the details and find out why you like that idea in the first place, and then digest it, reprocess it through your own, lens with your prior experience and with your other influences and tastes, and then you reprocess it into a new idea, and it feels new, but it feels like it refers to something else without directly. Nobody in Equalizer the Divide looks at the camera and says, visionaries, kids, tell your parents, go buy one today.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, because you look at someone like George Lucas, and in his heyday, that's exactly what he was doing. I mean, that's all Star Wars is.
Yeah.
And so that's actually, to get one thing also back to the point, is like when I was thinking about this, is like, who's doing that today? And, in today's society. One of the things that I've looked to is, like, we're all toy collectors. We still buy toys when we're in our 30s and all that. And it's interesting because there's almost three levels of toy collecting now. Back in the day, there was toys for kids that whoever bought. And then at some point in the 90s, there was more specialty toys. McFarlane got into the business, and they started making more intricate things that aren't really for kids. It's, you know, there's two groups now. There's the collectors, and then there's the people who buy toys to play with them. Now there's almost like a third level that goes beyond collecting into like this, well, an example of it would be the whole kid robot vinyl toy market that are amazingly expensive, amazingly simple. It's more about art than it is about toys. And
sure, I forgot about that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's okay. No, I was actually reading the book by the guy who started the Kid Robot store in, I think, San Francisco or something like that, Paul Budnitz. And in his introduction, now, I don't agree with this statement, but it was interesting that he was very adamant about saying that nostalgia is the enemy of this toy market, of these vinyl art toys, that you can't bring past things into these toys. It has to be completely new and just completely creative and come from this brand new place. Even if it's weird or you don't understand it, you know, it doesn't matter. And, you know, they have posters up on their, you know, their cubicle walls that say, you know, nostalgia is death. Yet at the same time, even on that level, when you look at these vinyl toys, 50% of them are nostalgic. 50% of them are taking Star Wars and morphing it onto a vinyl figure. And even like the big companies are starting to get into this now. Marvel and a couple of the other, I don't know if it's toys, I'm not sure who does the Marvel toys anymore, but they're coming out with these lines of these artistic vinyl figures that are going to be higher priced and more expensive. Yet at the same time, it's totally playing off of the nostalgia of, well, I like Spider-Man, so I'll get this Spider-Man vinyl. And it's interesting that it's almost like you can't avoid it to some extent. You just can't help. And I'm wondering, at what point do you stop yourself in that process and turn it into something new, or just stick with what's already there? You know, considering, I guess, what you're mapping it onto is the new thing. So if the vinyl toy structures, then, you know, that's what's being creative. How it looks is the influence. I don't know. It's like, at what point in the creative process do you find that fork in the road? And it seems like when I go back and it seems like when you go back and you look in the 80s, it seems like so many more people were taking the fork into creative new things, whereas now it seems like everyone's taking a fork. And it probably all boils down to money, but it seems like everyone's taking the other fork.
Well, I don't know. I mean, because, you know, John, have you watched the Crimson Ghost serials? The old...
No, I haven't.
Hoover's seen them. Hoover introduced me to them, actually. And when you watch that, you can almost see where the whole concept of Joe versus Cobra came from. I mean, as a matter of fact, the plot of the Crimson Ghost serials was very similar to the Pyramid of Darkness. It was a device that destroyed electrical impulses and made machines unusable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Hoover, you still there?
Yep.
Okay. So I mean, and plus the bad guy wears a mask, he's costumed, nobody knows who he is. The hero is just this kind of rugged scientist type of character. He's smart, but he's also good with his fists kind of thing. So when I was watching that, I was like, man, this must have really informed a lot of the writing of G.I. Joe. So it was where they took some aspects which were very visually the same, the masked villain, the hero in just the brown shirt and pants, and also the plot in general, like the whole chase after the device that destroys electricity thing. I guess like the format was totally different, because like they serialized it into a weekly episodic television show, and then eventually daily, whereas the Crimson Ghost was just like a weekly matinee that ran for, what, like 20 episodes or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
And it was 20 episodes of one continuing story rather than a bunch of self-contained episodes. So format-wise, it changed, but like some visuals crossed over and some of the core concept crossed over. But then they injected their own new stuff, like in terms of creating a larger cast and everything. But, I mean, besides the toys, now to get back to what Sean was talking about with like wholesale just reissuing of stuff, besides the toys, is there anything else going on in entertainment that you guys can point to right now that says that this is just a rehashing of the same old idea? Because I'm watching a lot of cartoons, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of that happening in animation, necessarily. I mean, outside of...
Yeah. It almost seems like animation is resistant to that. I think we're going to start seeing it a little bit more if things like the Transformers movie work out. But no, I mean, the whole Cartoon Network movement, the whole Adult Swim movement, that stuff has all been pretty creative and interesting. I'm seeing it in stuff like, I don't know, maybe like in comics, especially like the big companies, and even the smaller companies. It's like all of these 80s cartoon properties have their own comic series to one extent or another. I don't know.
Actually, no, and now that you mention comics, that's an interesting thing to bring up because of the whole thing that happened with Infinite Crisis the last couple years, which was, I remember a comics creator said in a podcast, it was like watching a Civil War reenactment because it was just like a big celebration. If it wasn't Crisis on Infinite Earths, great, let's do it again. So, and I'm not taking a stance on that either way. I'm just saying that there were a lot of Infinite Crisis was a tribute to the original Crisis on Infinite Earths, right, Hoop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I think what's getting overlooked here is that, you know, animation companies tend to be new. They don't own anything. Like, Filmation is still around, but, you know, who else is still around from the 80s as far as animation companies go? I mean, is Funimation even still around? Like, I don't think they are. And my point is, since all these companies are new, they don't really own anything. So they can't participate like these old-school toy companies can in the rebirth of all these old properties. Because Mattel's sitting on He-Man. Mattel owns He-Man outright.
Yeah.
You know, they're sitting on it. It is financially a good thing for them to just bring it back out every 20 years. Why not, you know? But the animation companies, there's nothing that they're sitting on that's 20 years old that they could just bring back out.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you look at that He-Man cartoon that came out, that was, what, Mike Young Productions?
Yep.
There were so many strings and red tape. There was so much involved in bringing that show out that it crumbled on itself because it was too hard to sustain between Mattel owning, you know, this portion of the rights and them doing the animation and owning this portion of it to a point where it's like, It even coming out on DVD is like, you know, even though there's a successful He-Man DVD line through BCI, it's like they had a hard time getting the rights to distribute the DVDs because of all the red tape involved.
Yeah.
And in
comparison, you look to, you know, the toy companies and you look to the comic companies where they own all these things. It's financially very smart for them to just rehash all this stuff that's already been established. Not only does it touch on the nostalgia factor, you know, like, you know, someone like our dads, you know, could have hypothetically grown up reading Justice League and, you know, it's still around today. So there's that factor. Plus, in today's comic market, you know, just to touch on the whole comic world, it's really hard to get people to come onto a new concept in comics when comics cost $3 a pop. So why not just milk what's already been popular all this time and, you know, gobble up the existing properties like, you know, G.I. Joe, Transformers, He-Man, you know, bring those back because you know that the audience is there. If you do something new, who knows what will happen? You know, it could tank overnight. But,
yeah,
you know, something with a built-in audience, you know, there you go. You know, out of the gate, you're coming kind of strong.
And that's why I tell everybody, go read Sugary Cereals at SugaryCereals.com because it's a brand new thing, and who knows if it's going to tank or not.
Exactly. So you got to go to the website right now. You're already online listening to the podcast, so type it in, Sugary Cereals. It's SERIALS. And actually, before you go, fix yourself some sugary cereal, be it Frosted Flakes, be it Honey Nut Cheerios, be it Fruit Loops.
Very.
But not Cocoa Krispies. You don't want to eat that. No, I'm just joking. But yeah, just go to the website and look. See, that's the great thing, though. I mean, you make my point for me. I mean, who wants to invest $3 into some new comic book series that you don't know anything about, but your comic book series are free.
Right.
No, that's,
wow.
It's funny when you bring that up, because I'm just thinking about, like, when I first got into comics, heavily. It was like I had all these, you know, I had the spinner rack in front of me, and I had all your basic, you know, your Spider-Mans, your Moon Knights, your X-Men, your Hulk, your, you know, I never really got into the DC stuff. I don't know if the stores didn't carry it or if I was just blind to that, but, and it was, I had to pick the one that formatted me or spoke to me, but it's like I didn't stray from that for a very long time. That is interesting. And later on, it definitely became a price thing. I recently went back into a comic store, and I picked up, the Dark Tower comic, the Stephen King comic, and it was $5, and I walked out of there with sticker shock, and it's like, man, this is why I stopped collecting comics.
Yeah. And that's why Sugary Cereals is so great, because you could type in Sugary Cereals right now on your browser, and you could get a world of free entertainment right in front of you.
Is it truly free, Hoover? Is it really free?
Oh, it's really free. You don't
that
have to
like
put a quarter in your disk drive. You can just go to this website, type in sugarycereals.com,
and
there you will have it.
If you type it in now, you can also get free PSP, CDZ, and PDF downloads to read offline at your convenience. That's right, Sugary Cereals.
Limited time offer.
Actually, no, it's every day of the week.
Every day offer.
No, but that is a major reason that I went online is that comics. I mean, even if a guy loves comics more than almost anything, you know.
He's a genius, that man.
What? No, this wasn't my idea.
I'm just saying you got around that whole problem of, you know, new readers to new comics by not charging anything.
Well,
so you found a way around it. I mean, you charge on the back end. You know, if you want to buy a print copy, go for it. But you don't really see the big two, you know, offering that much content for free on their websites. I think that's going to change.
Yeah,
I think it is slowly already changing, but very slowly.
Right.
I think you're a pioneer in this.
Well, I'm with a fleet of real pioneers. I'm just following them. You know, they kind of set the path, and I'm just like it's like when like the gold rush in California happened. And I'm like 1850. You know, instead of 1849, I'm 1850 following out there. So. I want to make that very clear. I didn't, by no means
well,
I think of myself as
no,
a visionary.
Yeah, I'm not saying Jersey created this thing called web comics. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that you're taking all of its strengths and you know, giving the material out there for people so we didn't get hooked on it.
And to be fair about it, you know, kind of what I think what you're kind of speaking to indirectly is how there's still a misunderstanding about the whole idea of what web content is that I got a friend who I won't name who's kind of in the industry, in the print industry, and he uses terminology like the free guys, you know, and he doesn't say that necessarily disparaging way, but he says it in a way that kind of suggests that somehow it's not quite the same or as good as working for Marvel and DC if you're one of the free guys. And it's clear that he doesn't quite understand the concept of what we're aiming for by giving it away. We're not giving it away because we can't charge for it. We're giving it away because we can't fight City Hall on their terms.
Yeah.
We have to find another way to fight City Hall. And one of the ways is to find an audience by giving it away and then charging later. Win their enthusiasm, win their affection, and then say, well, do you like it enough to own it? And they go, yeah, okay, $350. Okay, great.
Yeah, that's just what the gang at HomestarRunner.com has done. You know, you have all these cartoons free online, and well, I own 5 DVDs of them, which I paid for. They're all free online, but I wanted them on DVD, so I paid for them.
Right.
So,
we talked about this before. Is like we buy TV seasons on DVD. People buy a Lost TV season or Heroes on DVD, and it's on TV. You know.
Yep.
This isn't like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, where it's not on there anymore. You know.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure Sean has some thoughts on this, being that he runs Buried in DVDs, also a companion blog to Brennan in the 80s. And what a great blog name that is. I can't imagine what genius came up with that name.
I have no idea. It was totally
awkward.
There was a fairy that tapped me on the ear.
Are you calling Hoover a fairy?
In the, you know, winged with the little wand sense, but... you know, it's funny, too. This is bubbling over into so many other facets of media. There's a whole bunch of people that are using the blog format to publish their books now for free, just like webcomics. And it's funny because they're hitting the exact same wall for made up of editors and published authors that are like, this is ridiculous, this is crazy, you're obviously not good at this because, you know, if you were good at this, you'd be being published and being paid and all this stuff. And it's funny that there is so much backlash within the industry of the thing that you're trying to find a new way into. I don't know if it's because the people themselves feel threatened by a new format or a new way of looking at things, but...
I think initially people are always sort of threatened by a newness to an industry that has been around a long, long time, like comics or like books. And when people find new ways into it, people are so used to the old rules that when someone comes along and breaks them, they're like, what are you doing? You can't do that. And people get sort of scared and think of those people as less legitimate. At least that's what it seems like. And, you know, I kind of understand it because, you know, technically anyone can publish a book these days. You have sites like Lulu.com where you just, you know, send them your manuscript and they will print your book to order.
Also mention Kablam.com, who is the print publisher of Sugary Cereals.
There you go.
K-A-B-L-A-M.com. We got to give a plug to, you know, the guys who fund us.
Yeah. But, I mean, basically that levels the playing field to the point where anyone can write a book. Anyone can write a book. It doesn't matter how many typos are in it. It doesn't matter if the book goes anywhere. You know, there's no judge. And... you know, you got to understand, you know, that the published authors, the guys who had to jump through all these hoops, of course they feel a little chagrined because there was absolutely no hoops for these people to jump through. And, you know, I kind of see both sides of the story because I'm sure a lot of those books that, you know, don't have to go through the hoops, I'm sure they're absolutely horrible. But I'm sure there are some absolutely genius ones out there as well that, you know, haven't been ruined by certain editors. They're like, well, I think the story has to go like this, you know, and people who are more closed-minded as to what, and more formulaic as to what a story has to be. Yes, you.
Yes, me. My
I'm calling on you.
I have a cocktail. I just wanted to go down two minor tributaries, okay? And these will be very minor, very quick. One is, I know I've told this story before in other places. I don't know if I've told it here, but when I was a teenager and I was stupid, I remember asking my dad. I was talking to my old man about I was talking about cultural history, and I said to him, "How come most of the stuff from ancient times?" Old times, mm-hmm. You know, they go back to like the 1800s, Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, all that stuff. How come it's all good? How come no garbage existed back then? And in my stupid teenage naivete, I thought, well, everything in the old days must have been great because all the stuff that we have from there is great. And my dad looked at me and said, no. He's like, you know, stuff that's garbage, people forget about. And it doesn't get republished and repackaged and redistributed. So the stuff that is good and speaks to the widest possible audience and speaks to something that's truly human, that's the stuff that gets carried over, and that's why all the old stuff is good. So the stuff that's really crud now that you're worried about, that ain't going to be around in a couple hundred years because it's not going to be memorable. So that's my answer to the whole notion of stuff being bad because of the bar being lowered, the entry fee being lowered. Is that, okay, well, yeah, there's going to be a lot of junk, but it ain't going to be around forever because, first of all, it's not going to be good enough to be memorable, and second of all, typically, if it's not good enough to be memorable, the people who are making it aren't really fully invested, and they tend to give up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the second minor tributary, which I now lost track of.
Okay, well, you try to remember it as I jump in with this tributary. And not every toy line from the 1980s has returned. You know, it's just as you say, you know, only the cream rises to the top, only the strong survive. I mean, Max Steel's Robo Force, never made a comeback. If you don't remember, Max Steel's RoboForce were these lines of basically these trash can shaped robots.
Which were really cool, by the way.
Jersey likes them. I'm not saying they were horrible, but all they were really were like trash can shaped cylindrical robots. And their great action feature was you pushed a button on their back and their arms sort of went into a hugging motion. So, you know, hugging or squeezing, whatever it was.
They had the technology of the bendy straw.
Yeah,
thing,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so basically this toy line was a bunch of cylindrical robots who could all hug each other or crush each other, I guess, depending on their strength. And they even had, like, vehicles and stuff to ride around in.
Yep.
Now, this toy line didn't come back. I can't really imagine kids today playing with a bunch of cylindrical robots that all hug.
Well, and you know what else didn't come back? Monchi Cheese, who also hugged. So I think the moral here is anything that hugged doesn't
apparently,
care.
Hugging is not in today's society or world.
Apparently,
we live in anti-hugging.
What were you saying, John?
Unless you go to Epcot, because there are freaking Munchie Cheese everywhere in Epcot.
Whoa.
Yes,
wow.
I know. I was freaked out. I went this past summer, and my God, so many thumb sucking monkeys.
Oh my God!
I could kind of see how Disney and hugging would go hand in hand.
True.
Or arm in shoulder, but
arm in shoulder or a thumb in mouth.
But yeah, my point is that, you know, not everything makes a comeback. It seems like everything from the 80s is back, but you know, some stuff has been forgotten, and it was mainly stuff that Jersey liked and no one else liked. So
that's funny too, because I always. No, you can go ahead, Jersey.
Oh, sorry, Sean. I've been talking too much. You go ahead.
Jersey desperately wants to defend Max Steel's RoboForce, and if he isn't let, he's just going to explode.
No.
Well, look, one of the properties that I always thought was huge when I was a kid was Thundercats, but apparently it wasn't nearly as big as I thought. Maybe it wasn't in cartoon form, but like there wasn't that many toys made, and even though I think it's sort of like the hidden gem of the 80s stuff, it's like... Sure, the DVDs came out, and there, I think there's a big budget movie in the next, which is crazy, but no toys, no you know, ancillary stuff, except you can probably find Thundercat stickers anywhere, but that was always one of
the I would say that is a glaring omission. I mean, where I grew up, we didn't get Thundercats on TV, so I really have very little history with it. So I personally never became a fan. But I would say that is clearly the most popular 80s toy line that has not made a revival. And I think if anything is going to make a revival still and has yet to happen, I think it's going to be Thundercats.
Well,
that's my bold prediction for 2008 or 2009.
I've been hearing rumors of a Thundercats film being made. Is that not
yes,
true?
Yes, live action.
That's true. And if that happens, I think a toy line is for sure a go. I think the key here... is that I can't remember who made the Thundercats figures, but I'm pretty sure it was not Hasbro or Kenner or Mattel.
LPN.
Yeah, and I don't think they're doing anything these days, so the rights to the toys are probably in a bit of a limbo and not so easily whipped back out like Mattel did with He-Man or like Hasbro has with G.I. Joe or Transformers. I think had Thundercats been held by one of the companies that were still pumping out toys today, I think they already would have come back. But I think there probably is a lot of legal rigmarole that has to be gone through before those make a comeback.
Not to derail your Thundercats pontification, but I remember what my other tributary was now.
Go for it.
Okay, this is again in defense of, you know, my wife was reading that book by Andrew Keen, The Cult of the Amateur. Have you guys heard of this?
Are you telling everyone that you're married yet again? Are you going to do this every podcast?
Hey, guess what, Hoover? You know who else is married? Sean Robert.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, my wife
is this, this is a... Are you and Lady J double-team me? What's going on here? Anyway, go back to your little point.
Well, Sean was saying something, and you stepped on him yet again, Hoof.
That's okay. I was just saying my wife was here. So.
See? Oh, she's in the room. Wow.
Jeez, no girls can stand to be in the same room as me.
Sean and I both know what love is, but Hoover, yeah. The last.
I want to know what love is.
I hear a song cue. Okay, back to, you know.
Anyway.
Let's talk about me again for a second here, okay?
Yeah, let's do. Let's talk about your wife.
Yeah, no, not talking about. No, but she was reading this book, Cult of the Amateur, and she was starting to get a little nervous because the book is essentially about how awful Web 2.0 is because it allows just anybody to produce media, which is going to create mm-hmm. this whole, you know, dumbing down society and everything. And that's a valid fear, but at the same time, I like to think that people are smarter than that. But anyway, my answer to the whole gateway of the publishing world and that there are editors and people out there who help refine ideas to make them better so that they resonate more, my answer to that is there's also a negative aspect. For instance, I do freelance illustration, and one of the projects I work on is I designed and I continue to update a mascot for a nonprofit organization who endorses healthy eating habits. And mm-hmm. I remember at one point they contacted me to design a comic book series for this character to kind of, through the story, exemplify the why kids should eat good and create a mythical arena for this battle to happen between bad eating and good eating and exercising, right? And mm-hmm. I was thrilled to have that opportunity because I was already in the process of working on the front, and I had developed all these ideas about writing for kids, about like the formula that you can use and how the old cartoons did it, and I was really just itching to get my hands on something which was a brand new property, and I could, you know, kind of test my vision out on this thing. So I introduced this villain who emphasized bad eating habits, and what's more is he was out to make the world lazy and sluggish and full of salty food so that he could just take over without any resistance. I thought, that's a pretty neat idea. Not brilliantly creative, but it's a neat idea. And the people, the art directors and the people who ran the business, the nonprofit organization, would constantly come back to me saying, well, you know, this villain, he's kind of big, and we don't want overweight children to feel bad. So can you make it better? And I said, well, but, you know, he's supposed to be emphasizing bad eating habits, so shouldn't he be a little bit on the chunky side? And like, no, that'll make people feel bad. And, you know, he's kind of ugly. People aren't going to be able to relate to him. I'm like, they're not supposed to. He's a monster. That's what bad guys are. They're monsters that we can demonize and hate. That's the whole symbol system of comics and of mythology, right? And like, no, yeah. Well, you know, he shouldn't be quite that ugly because we don't want to make the ugly people feel bad. And so through their constant interference, I feel that the property is a lot less effective than what it could be. If they just would have, not to say that I'm the brightest guy in the entire universe on this, but I feel that I am pretty much in touch with what excited me as an 8-year-old, so I think that maps itself onto what excites 8-year-olds today, I hope. And so I was just using the things from our past and just re-injecting them into this new property, saying, well, let's make this like a 80s cartoon, but it'll endorse healthy eating habits, and then we'll trick the kids into eating better because they're just going to be so thrilled by the adventure that they're not going to care about the message. It'll just come through. It'll be between the lines, like a He-Man episode kind of thing. And it didn't turn out that way. It turned out to where it was a 4-page comic where there were kids in the park, and they didn't know what to do, and then this boy jumps out of a television and says, let's exercise, and they all start exercising. and then that's it. That's the end. It's like, hey, kids, we should exercise. And they all start just jumping jacks and throwing frisbees. And I was looking at that as a kid, and I was thinking, like, if I got this as a kid, I'd feel ripped off. I'd be like, oh, boy, a comic. Open it up. Oh, it's just kids doing jumping jacks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so you're basically saying editors don't always do good.
Right.
So anyone who self-publishes and goes around the editors, you know, there's a strong possibility that what they publish will actually be very good because it hasn't been touched by an editor, which is ironic because so many people in the book industry think it can't be good unless it's been touched by an editor.
Well,
so I think you really have, well, it's opposing viewpoints, sure. But I think in all media right now, be it web content, be it television content, be it book content, you have two different sides. You know, you have basically the tried and true, a lot of cooks in the kitchen mode, which is how most books are published these days, and how most TV shows come to light and how most movies come to light. And you have a lot of the underground stuff that's sort of revolting against that model. And a lot of it has turned out to be really good. So people are sort of looking into it, you know, not just to exploit it for their own goals, but just because it's popular. And let's see what we can do with this. So I think you're sort of having a revolt in every industry right now that sort of is doing the opposite of what's always been done. And I think that's a good thing. You know, you're going to turn up with a lot of trash, but have you looked at what's on TV and in books and everything lately? Even the big companies are producing a whole lot of trash. So why not have this whole grassroots movement of people that is quite full of trash, but all the official stuff is also full of trash. So why not? You know, why not have to sift through all this trash to get the good stuff? Because you're already having to do it. And you know, the big world of books and movies and TV anyway.
That was a wonderful justification for being a free guy. That's all we really are.
As once you sift through all the trash on the internet, you're going to end up at sugarycereals.com and you're going to go, wow, it's like a whole new world has opened up for me without any trash in it. And we're going to go, yes, kids, and you're going to love it, and you're going to go to it every day, because how often does it update, Jersey?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Hoover, because it does update every day. As a matter of fact, it's even
updating
on the
every day.
Right now. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Every day it updates for free with new content?
All right, let's not do this again.
But act now and you'll get a free slicer and dicer.
Actually, no, you won't. Is it too arrogant of me to say that I'm really proud of the page that's updated today? I don't know if you've been to Sugary Cereals today, but it's got a very action-y shot, and I was really happy with that page, so I just wanted to point that out.
So anyone listening right now should go quickly to sugarycereals.com.
And look for the Saturday.
Look at today's page.
Well, Saturday, November 3rd, right? Isn't that today? Yeah.
I think so.
Who am I? How to get here? So.
When am I?
Sean, did you have any thoughts on that? And Hoover and I were kind of going back and forth quite a bit about that.
No, I think you guys were pretty hitting the nail on the head.
We managed to completely throw off the whole topic of 80s revival stuff.
Well, the 80s revival stuff came back because it's good, and companies still own that stuff, so why not bring back a good thing? To touch on something Jersey asked earlier, I would say a lot of that stuff doesn't need to be reinvented. And I think if you try to reinvent it, you just get too many weird results, like the Michael Bay Transformers or the Dolph Lundgren He-Man movie. And it just becomes the what?
G.I. Joe Extreme.
Yeah, G.I. Joe Extreme is another good example where it's like, you watch it, and you just go, well, why did you change this? If the change isn't readily apparent why it was done, then something went wrong. And I think change can be good. I think I will go on record. For me personally, I will say the 2002 He-Man cartoon is better than the 1983 He-Man cartoon. Jersey will disagree with that.
I totally disagree.
Well, see, that's just different tastes. It's not different enough to where anyone was going, what's this? This is weird.
No, you're right. You're right. As a matter of fact, I was going to bring up, and I was going to ask Sean if he's seen this, but you remember the Deke G.I. Joe series. Now, I know that this is a kind of a hot-button issue with Joe fans, but one of the things about it is, as a reimagining goes, it's pretty true to the original, at least as far as concept and general execution, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't a completely new animal. It was essentially the same idea with new characters and just kind of was processed through a new filter. Sean, did you ever watch those G.I. Joe episodes?
No, I don't think we got those in my area.
Well, to warn you, if it ever does come out on DVD, it is very, very lighthearted by comparison to the original G.I. Joe. I mean, it's in my opinion, it's very comparable to Robots in Disguise Transformers, to Gen 1 Transformers. You have episodes where Cobra Commander wants to get into a funky dance club, and they'll let Sergeant Slaughter in, but not Cobra Commander. And so Cobra Commander is, like, you know, beating the floor with his fist saying, I hate my life, you know?
Basically, everything was the same except for the tone. You know, there were new characters, just like every season of G.I. Joe. But they were like, what if we made this less serious? So suddenly you had, like, people falling off mountains, and there was the slide whistle sound effect, like, and you know, if you're used to the Sunbow episodes, you know, up through and including the movie, and then you turn these on, you're like, what in the world is going on?
Well,
you know,
you have to sort of
put your head into it and realize that it's really not that different. There's just one element. It's a rocky thing to make the adjustment at first, but once you make the adjustment, it's just like when we talked about Robots in Disguise. You know, you just have to make that initial adjustment, and then you're like, okay, well, here's the deal with this.
Yeah,
and then you understand.
If you look at it as almost a parody of G.I. Joe, or at least Cobra Commander is a parody of Cobra Commander in that series.
Yeah.
And you look at episodes like Stuck on You, where Cobra Commander is getting chased around the jungle by a gorilla who reminds him of some woman that he once loved.
Yeah, yeah. Actual episode. You have a gorilla chasing Cobra Commander for an entire episode because the gorilla's in love with Cobra Commander.
Yeah, yeah. So... But the main story, the A story in that episode, is a classic G.I. Joe motif of the hero and the villain getting trapped in a situation where they have to work together to get out. Cobra Commander and Pathfinder are trapped in the jungle and they have to work together to escape the jungle. And meanwhile, there's this funny part where the gorilla keeps making kissy faces at Cobra Commander.
Yeah.
But my point is that there's different ways to reimagine something. You can take something and just, like Robots in Disguise, Transformers, and take everything that worked about it and keep it there and just change the tone entirely. And have funny jokes, like really silly jokes, slapstick jokes. So,
as opposed to something like, you know, the Michael Bay Transformers movie or the Dolph Lundgren He-Man movie, where they changed, you know, this, that, the other thing, and also this thing over here, and you watch the end result, and you're like, well, what is this? You know, you're left baffled because they just changed a few too many things.
Let me ask you this, do you think that actually hinders the actual franchise overall in the sense that it creates a barrier for new people to glom on to the other aspects of the franchise? What I mean by this is like, a kid who goes to see the Transformers movie, the newest one, if you show him a Gen 1 episode or even like a Cybertron episode or Armada episode, recent ones, you think that they're going to be able to recognize that this is the same thing?
Well, I think personally that there's too much deviation from source material in these properties. I think when you keep putting out different deviations of it, it can weaken the brand as a whole, because over time you're like, well, what does this brand really represent? And I think Transformers has done an okay job of this, because there's always the recurring theme of transforming robots from an alien galaxy. But I really think for the most part there should be a little more recurring than there has been with this property.
What are your thoughts on that, Sean?
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about, like, the new Transformers cartoon that's coming out on Cartoon Network. And this is the first time where, though the cartoon is more or less staying true to the concept, I think the toy line that's going to be following it is going to be full of figures that don't transform. It's just going to be robots, or you buy the vehicle for them. And you don't actually have a toy that's doing something. So one of the base concepts of the thing is being changed. And I'm curious if how that's going to affect, you know, kids who watch the movie, because at least the movie toys now, or at least half of the movie toys transform. I'm wondering maybe how much that, you know, if kids, you know, glom onto that and say, well, you know, this is totally fine. This is just, you know, this is just how you do it now. You have to buy these two different forms in order to get this thing that this character does in the show. Yeah, I don't know.
Wow. I didn't realize that they were actually going to be two separate toys. That's kind of diabolical.
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was just going to say, if you've seen the character design on the toys, I don't know how they can make that transform.
I think they actually are somehow, some way going to transform. I don't understand it myself either. But I think kids, for the most part, are smarter than we ever give them credit for. Because, I mean, right now you have kids out there who are like 7, and they're buying Transformer movie toys, and they grew up watching Transformers Cybertron on Cartoon Network, and they know that it's a different thing, just like we knew as kids that the G.I. Joe comic and the G.I. Joe cartoon were slightly different things. And I think it's always sort of built in to any concept that can cross media. But I think at the same time, you know, like Jersey always has these ideas that he's going to get the rights to G.I. Joe and do G.I. Joe comics. But Jersey wants to do G.I. Joe comics based on the cartoon continuity. And, you know, as much as I would like to read those, I always have to warn him that I don't think fans really want those.
You're right.
I don't believe I said that, but I think the fans who read G.I. Joe as a comic are used to having the same comic continuity all his time, and if you bring him out a comic about the TV show, then they're going to go, well, now we have all these different universes. Like when a couple years back, Devil's Due decided to reinvent the whole G.I. Joe franchise from scratch, and they came out with a comic called G.I. Joe Reloaded, which they kept doing the original comic, which had all the old continuity, but they also did this other comic that was basically starting G.I. Joe from scratch. Well, it only lasted like less than a year. I don't think there's really room in such a property like G.I. Joe to have all these different iterations of it that are just slightly different. I think it sort of weakens the core concept, because then you have characters who are the same character but with different histories. And in this continuity, you know, Cobra Commander is a car salesman. And in animated continuity, Cobra Commander is this Cobra Law guy who was on Earth before humans were. And I think that a property has to be really great in other areas and really excel in those other areas to get by with that sort of diversity in, I guess, the original concepts and theme. And I think G.I. Joe has done it, but I think once you get this sort of disparity in the different forms of G.I. Joe, it's sort of, you know, you ask yourself, well, which is G.I. Joe? Well, the answer is it all is, but should it have been different to begin with? And that's a very long-winded way of saying that it's always really been this way, but I think just about any good property could stand to have, you know, more cohesiveness and less versions of the story, and just have like one concrete version. That's just what I think. That's probably a fairly unpopular opinion, though.
So, Oof, you don't like Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham?
Well, that to me is different. That's just like a parody to me.
Mm.
I don't see anything wrong with parodies. But, you know, I was a big X-Men fan as a kid, and the way one of the first exposures I had to the X-Men was on the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends TV show. Well, X-Men continuity on that TV show is way different than in the comic book. So I had to sort of get accustomed to that disparity as a kid. And, you know, it's not so difficult. Any kid can do it, and any kid does do it all the time. But it's like I feel it would have been stronger had the concept just translated more directly, and it would have more easily brought new readers of the comic into the fold if they look on TV and see the same exact characters that they would in the comic book.
And that's what I was driving at, is I was wondering if that was, like, for instance, I collected the Transformers comic at a very early age. I mean, the very first issue I bought was, I think, issue 6. It's the one with Shockwave blowing up Megatron on the cover. Remember that one?
Yeah,
I think Alan Kupperberg did the art. And I remember very quickly when the Dinobots showed up, it was like, how come they're not talking like cavemen? They're just talking like slangy. You know, and when Grimlock didn't talk like a caveman, I was like, they really shut me off. I was like, oh, this doesn't feel like the Dinobots to me, because I've seen them on television. They talk like, you know, the caveman babies.
Exactly.
So that was my question I wanted to put to both you and Sean, was do you think that the less cohesive, the weaker the brand is? Because, like, you know, a question I get from people who don't necessarily read a lot of comics is, boy, gee, this Spider-Man movie must be making comic sales just go through the roof. Because, Spider-Man's on the big screens, so everybody's going out to buy comics, right? And I'm like, well, no, not really, because when they pick up the comic, they see that Peter's married to MJ. I'm like, hey, this isn't like the movie. And how come actually they gave him the organic web shooters now, didn't they? But, or like the X-Men, for that matter, when the movie comes out and everybody's wearing black leather, and then you have the comic and Wolverine's wearing yellow and blue, you know?
Exactly.
This is something that...
Go ahead, Sean.
This is something that's always fascinated me, and from my experience, like, I mean, I also grew up on the X-Men, but the benefit I had growing up on the X-Men is that it had the same consistent writer for so long that it was, you know, the core property really didn't deviate all that much. Even spinoff comics were written by Chris Claremont for a while, X-Factor, I think, and stuff. So, from my perspective, especially when I was a kid, one cohesive story totally made the difference. That's what made something strong and good. And I couldn't understand how people could get into other comics that were continuously cycling through different creators. And I noticed that once Chris Claremont left the X-Men, my interest waned.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, I'll look at other properties. Like, I'll look at something like Batman. And what really excites me about Batman is all these different creators' takes on this one core concept idea that I don't know if I would be as interested in an ongoing continuity, just because it's so long. There's so much involved with just the one series. And it's like I would feel like I would have no way of being able to absorb all that. I mean, that was a point I was getting to in the X-Men, is it was getting to a point where you'd read a comic and it was like, man, Chris Claremont forgot that he did this in this issue, and it totally doesn't make sense now. And
do you think, Sean, do you think that has to do with the fact that DC tends to have kind of iconic kind of mythical characters versus Marvel's real world kind of feel to it? Do you think that might have something to do with it?
Yeah, that probably has to. I mean, definitely. Because, I mean, if I look at something like Superman, it's like, I would definitely want to see a version of Superman, you know, before I, you know, like I said, went back and read the entire backstory. And, no, I definitely think that's true. I mean, and some of the Marvel characters, I think, are getting to that place, like Spider-Man. But, I don't know. I mean, that's something that endlessly fascinates me. I look at my wife, who's getting into comics, and it's funny how much, you know, differences will matter. She'll read one graphic novel, you know, or I definitely didn't go about this the right way, but I tried to introduce her to Batman through The Dark Knight, and she totally couldn't get into it because she had the Bruce Timm cartoon as a background. And then later on, you know, I sort of got her into, like, The Long Halloween, and that was a different art style than Frank Miller's, and it was a little bit more acceptable, I guess, or whatever. But it's funny how you'll put one comic in front of her and it's just totally, she can't even read it. It just doesn't gel because it's something that's a different iteration. I don't know.
I'm developing a theory on this, and I just started it, and I don't know. I mean, sometimes I feel like when I say theory, it comes off as, who the hell am I to say theory, because I'm just a kid still. I mean, in terms of, like, comic traders' careers, I mean, this is something that guy in his 50s comes up with. I feel like I'm still too young to say this, but I was having a conversation again with I bring this guy up all the time because not only do I like him, but I know him now personally, and it's really cool, and I like to show off about it. I was having a conversation with Dan Mishkin about Amethyst, Princess of Gemworld, which is one of my all-time favorite comics, so that's even more exciting than anyway. But we were talking about how we were talking about what happened after he left the book and Keith Giffen kind of came on. Now, Keith Giffen, as a creator, and I love Keith Giffen very deeply. I love his work. I've made that point clear in other podcasts. But when Giffen has a propensity to reimagine everything he steps onto, he's kind of an iconoclast. And he's like, he's one of those writers who comes on and says, well, now you're going to see the Keith Giffen version of this, right? That's what we do with Justice League. and Legion of Superheroes, for that matter. And so he has, like, a, people love him and they hate him. But when he came on Amethyst, he kind of, like, took it in a whole new direction. And Dan Mishkin and I were talking about that, and we weren't really making a value judgment on whether it was better or worse, but the thing we came to a consensus on was it was too early to reimagine it. The property was only a couple years old. And it seems to me that, here's my theory, is that a new property comes back to what we're talking about with He-Man, with Larry D'Amato. It needs to be under the vision of what, it has to have one guiding vision for a certain amount of time before you can start reimagining it. Because when you reimagine it, then it does feel to me like you're weakening it. If you have a one guiding vision for a certain amount of time, like Sean was just saying, Spider-Man is beginning to start to be able to have new reimaginings. But he's old enough now. He's been around for 40 years, whereas Amethyst had not been. So, and I think that that's part of why Amethyst kind of fell apart, is that maybe, I'm not, no comics historian, but it could be that that had something to do with it, is if you took, say, Booster Gold by Dan Jurgens, and then, like, 2 years after he was created, suddenly turned him into a dark and gritty character. It's like, well, where did the whole vision or branding of Booster Gold go? It didn't have enough time to take before we could reimagine it, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if there's some truth to that. And so I just think that there's, like, a case to be made for, like, what you guys are talking about, what made X-Men work for you was there was one vision for it. What made the Mike Young He-Man work as well as the original He-Man work was there was kind of essentially one guy kind of calling the shots on the Bible of the series. Beast Wars, why did that show resonate with us? Because there were two guys who kind of called all the shots. They said, here's the vision for the series, and let's stick to this. So I had a consistency throughout. And now you can take those ideas, and once they're old enough, like Transformers, I think, is at least mature enough now that you can kind of reimagine it over and over again, and I don't think you're going to lose too much. But I guess a case could be made for a singular vision on something. Something with a singular vision, whether you like it or not, is going to resonate at least to the degree that the creator invested into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I'm curious, going back to, like, I can't remember, it was the 30s and the 40s when the Looney Tunes were so big, how people took the different directors, because that's something about animation that's changed a lot over the years, is that back in the day, you would have all these different animation directors that had their particular style or take on a subject, and you had, like, your Bob Clampett that did these weird, crazy movements, you know, the characters would just go into these weird positions, and their heads would stretch, and then you'd get another character like Chuck Jones, who did something a little bit more structured, a little bit different. And, you know, at this going on at the same time where sometimes characters would change. I mean, you have a version of Daffy Duck that's basically insane, and then on the other hand, you have a version of Daffy Duck that's basically just sort of like the selfish, sort of more self-absorbed version of Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
Yet they were going on at the same time, and I wonder how people took that stuff then. You know, it's like now we look back on it, it's just the way it's always been. But at the time, I wonder if it was really jarring.
That's a really good question. I'm betting there's books written on this very subject that we should have researched. That's a good question to bring up as a basis for meditation for future episodes. Now I want to go and look at the library, see what I can find.
Well, I wonder going along with your theory, I wonder if you know, there's almost two approaches you can take where you either have to build up an icon and then work with the icon, or if from the very beginning, you know, maybe what's iconic about the character isn't necessarily character mannerisms as much as it is appearance or something, and then you can go in a million different directions at the beginning. As long as you stick to that, that maybe becomes the icon. That over time, maybe it'll become more about the character, but at the beginning, it's just about, experimenting with, you know, just a set of characters that completely change. I mean, on the one hand, I would think that would throw people off. You just wouldn't be able to stick. There's just, you're throwing too many things at people. But maybe that was, you know, maybe that was part of what made it good at the time.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I can remember as a kid, I watched, I'm guessing this was about 1982, but I would watch Tom and Jerry cartoons, and like, they would be, Tom and Jerry would be like pals in every episode. And then, like, I would discover these older Tom and Jerry cartoons where they would constantly be chasing, you know, Tom would be chasing Jerry for the entire episode, and the whole point was, like, I have to kidnap Jerry and eat him. But the ones that I was first introduced to, they were just like buddies. And I remember as a kid going, whoa, these are two different things. So I think that as it sort of progressed in time and they sort of took it in a different direction, a very more friendly direction, I would say, it's just how things tend to go, like, changing over time. But for me, as a kid, it left me confused, because here you had the show that seemed to be based on the fact that they were pals, and then you had these older shows where they did nothing but chase each other. It would be like if you saw a Transformer show today where Optimus Prime and Megatron are buddies, and they just sit around and play cards all the time. It would be like, huh? What? What's this? So I agree with what Sean is saying. There were a lot of disparities in, and not just characterization, but whole plot elements to the old, older cartoon characters. So that you know, even as a kid, that struck me as sort of odd.
And I'm curious,
so you have to,
based on
you have to wonder why they did that.
So what you said, I'm curious about whether it's due to licensing rights or if it's just popularity, that Tom and Jerry hour that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You don't see that on TV anymore, but you can still catch Tom and Jerry old ones on TV
these
days.
Yeah, it's almost like they were trying out a new direction back then, and it didn't really catch on because everyone was going, well, I thought he was going to chase him and eat him, and they're just like hanging out.
Sure,
so
it's
like they tried
that.
Something new, and it didn't go over, and now it's sort of been lost to time, because you really don't see those episodes anymore. It could be another case where they deviated a little bit too far from the original concept, and people just went, huh? And didn't stick.
Once again...
Go ahead, John.
I was going to say, once again, this will be interesting in the new Transformers cartoon, because I'm just going off of what I've read here, but I've been reading that they're sort of also going to scale down the whole Autobot versus Decepticon thing, and it's more going to be like the Autobots are going to sort of be like rescue heroes that help the human populace with earthquakes and you know, bank robberies and stuff like this. And then every once in a while they're going to throw some continuity in with Megatron and the Decepticons screwing things up for them. So it'll just be interesting to see if they're ready for that.
Wow.
I agree. It will be interesting because I don't think anyone is going to really go for this. I think it'll appeal to the fan. I think it will appeal to people who don't really like Transformers necessarily. I think it'll appeal to a lot of Teen Titans fans and fans that just have a general knowledge of the concept. I don't think it'll really appeal to a lot of hardcore fans, but we'll have to see. You know, I probably said very similar things to Robots in Disguise, and
yeah.
Then looked what happened with that.
Yep.
So we'll see, but I agree with what Sean is saying. It's out of the gate. It seems to be rather deviating from the original point. So we'll see if this deviates successfully or whether it deviates its way out of the public memory in a few years.
That's true. The deciding factor, I think, is going to be whether or not this was committee thinking, where they go, you know, kids can't relate to robots because they're robots, so we got to make it more about people. We got to have the robots eat food, and we got to have them, you know, skateboard and say cowabunga. Or if this is something where a real visionary has come in and said, you know, I got this really crazy idea. We're going to take the Decepticons out of the equation, make the Autobots rescue heroes, and this is why it's going to work, because my execution is going to be so unique, you know? That could be.
Hmm.
Like, nobody could have convinced me in 2000, the year 2000, that you could do a Transformers series where everybody's heads get big, you know, when they get frustrated, or that they would that there would be characters who turn into flying sharks and, you know, I have a lot of slapstick humor. Nobody could have convinced me that would be a good show until I saw it. So.
Well, to take that one step further, no one could have convinced us in 1995
yes.
when we saw Transformers that turned into cheetahs and dinosaurs and actual realistic looking animals that this was going to go over. We totally scoffed at those toys.
We did.
We were like, those are dumb. That's lame.
And I remember Hoover mailed me comic strips that he drew of Optimus and Megatron, the Gen 1 characters, going like, they go back in time and like, well, gee, I don't know what to do out here in the primitive Earth. What do you think we should do with our time? Well, let's rip the skins off of animals and put them on our bodies.
Yeah.
We were
and I was like, that's lame. That's never going to last. And then what happened is they brought out the show, and we were like, huh, that's kind of interesting. And then episode 3 airs, and we're like, oh, okay, that's kind of good. And then we get to episode 7, and we're like, oh, my God, this is great.
Well, yeah, and I was going to say, what did we say at the end of season 2? What were the words that we said over and over again at the last, like, 15 minutes?
By the time season 2 was there and the final episode airs, we're like, oh, my God! Oh, my God! This is awesome! So yeah, I mean, sometimes we can be completely wrong going we predict something's going to go.
What was the difference that Bob Ford and Larry DiTilio were the guiding voices on the show? They were given carte blanche. They have gone on record to say, like, Hasbro didn't even know what to do with Beast Wars. They said, here, make a story out of it. So like, it wasn't even clear at the start whether or not the Beast Wars characters were going to be from the same continuity as the Gen 1 characters. So, anyway,
in fact, they gave a lot of indications that they weren't. So we were like, it's a reimagining, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, and then
they revealed that, oh, surprise, it's all part of one big story. And we were like, oh, God!
And we really literally did. I remember screaming out loud at the end of season 2. Yeah. Oh, my God!
Yeah, we were screaming. We would get on the phone and scream at each other, oh, my God! Oh, man, did you see that? Oh, God!
It was like this weird middle ground between girls at a Beatles concert and guys watching a football game.
That's a good way to put it. And I was like, oh, Robert, he's so dreamy. Ah! And I passed out.
It's like a Tom Jones concert. But I heard Sean say something, and then we totally stomped all over him again.
No, I was just going to say that I'm still that possible convert that's hanging out in the wings. It's still back in 1995, going, I don't know. What is animals? So,
yeah.
We shall see. I still need to break into those episodes.
See, that's the great thing about things being so readily available on DVD these days is that, boom, all of Beast Wars is on DVD, so you can experience it brand new right now. I didn't see a Visionaries cartoon until, I think it was 2003. That thing came out in 1987. It was only because of the magic of DVD that I was able to see that series, and I fell in love with that series, 16 years after it aired and was canceled.
Yep.
So that is the great thing about DVDs right there.
This is so another tributary, but of the whole HD Blu-ray war going on, I can't remember which format it is. One of them is region-free. And pushing for that region because that's the one aspect of DVD that I can't stand because I've got this moral center to me that's like, you know my warranty is going to be revoked if I unregionify my DVD player to watch British DVDs. So many cartoons are being released in Britain that aren't being released here.
Yeah, that's very true. And weird things that you wouldn't think would be released in Britain, like the 1966 Marvel cartoons, including Captain America. You can buy Captain America on DVD in Britain, but you can't get it here. Explain that to me.
You can get all the versions of Voltron, all the Vehicle Force and all that stuff in Australia.
Wow.
I don't know what's up with that. And what's funny is so many of these properties originated here.
Yeah, that is really strange how that happens. Well, my suggestion around that is to do research online and find the cheapest DVD player you can that you can make region-free. In 2002, I bought a DVD player that was $68, and I could make it region-free, and it's only just now starting to not work as well. So, you know, I got a good 5 years out of this $68 DVD player that I was able to make region-free. And now I just have to do the same process all over again and figure out what current DVD players are region-free
and
look for
the
cheapest one.
There's a good database on, I think it's DVDhelp.com. I think it's
I think that's the one, yeah. So, yeah, you just have to do that because in today's world, it is really a crapshoot as to where DVDs are going to end up. I mean, case in point, we were talking about the Robots in Disguise DVDs. We can get them as British imports. That's region two. You know, we have to have a region-free player to play these.
But I think it's funny. I mean, once again, it's just emphasizing this. But there's I'm really into spaghetti westerns, and there's a movie that was released called Death Rides a Horse. That the only region that got it is in Japan, where you can get a nice crisp version of the movie in Korean, subtitled in Japanese.
Oh my gosh!
Yes, if you take that version and you take the audio from the public domain American versions and mix them together, eventually, at some point, you'll have a watchable version.
Holy smokes.
Crazy world.
Well,
it's really crazy how that ends up happening.
I was a spiral listening to an ad for Sugar Cereals again, saying, like, we're all region free.
Every day of the week.
Well, no, I was saying, like, this is something that I think is part of this whole Web 2.0 movement, isn't it, where it's about freeing up the content for, I mean, there's bands now that are putting out their music for free. Like, what was it, Radiohead did that thing where they were like, they said, hey, pay what you feel for it, you know, and they just want it distributed. And part of the reason that we're having these DVD woes is because there's all these guys with, like, the rights to this stuff, like, keeping a stranglehold on it, saying, no, not until you give me the right amount of money am I going to let you distribute this thing. Whereas, like, the creators themselves just want the stuff out there. So, that's a new day is dawning in that front. But, it just sucks that we're the stuff that we fell in love with is still under the hold of the old guys with the vest underneath their coat with the pocket watch hanging there and the big cigar.
Monocle and the mustache that they're twiggling.
Yeah, they all look like that too. So, have we done sufficient discussion for this podcast? I mean, we talked for quite a bit about this stuff. I think we can probably wrap it up. Take it on another day. So,
yeah.
Quick announcements for the end of this show. We're going to be at the Mid-Ohio Con. Sugary Cereals is going to have a presence there, and that's in Columbus, Ohio, and it's November 24th and 25th, if I'm not mistaken. It's Thanksgiving weekend, and you can find out more information at midohiocon.com. Simple enough. And you can find out more information on the Sugary Cereals site, sugarycereals.com. Where can we find more information about you guys?
You go first, Sean.
Okay. You can find my inane ramblings at brandedinthe80s.com. 80s is 80s. And sometimes buried in DVDs, though. Not recently.
Not since Beetlejuice.
Not since Beetlejuice. I fell off my Tim Burton bandwagon.
But they're not inane ramblings. They're actually, if you enjoyed this conversation, which I guess one could argue was inane ramblings, then you should definitely check out his site. There's all deep and insightful thoughts into why he loves the stuff he loves is there. And I'm sure for at least some of you who grew up in the 80s, it will resonate to you because it does for me and Hoof. So.
Sean has a real gift of managing to put into words his love for certain things. You know, it takes a good writer to really go beyond. Optimus Prime was cool because he liked to shoot Megatron and stuff. But if you read anything that Sean writes about Garbage Pail Kids, about Long John Silver's, about anything, it instantly becomes captivating. And I'm glad that he's out there to do that.
And what I think is truly magical about his site, and it sounds dumb to say magical, but it is he finds a way to put himself in the mindset he was then and explain why it was fascinating, as well as what he thinks now. And it's never in a sense of, oh, I was so dumb then. It's more or less of sometimes it's scratching his head going, gee, why was I fascinated with that girl mouse character at Showbiz Pizza? And other times it's more of a standing back analysis of, boy, there sure were some weird-looking characters in the background of the Galaxy High episodes.
We won't get into specifics on that.
And it's just, you know, there are some posts on Sean's site that some parents might not find suitable for kids, but I think your site is more or less for adults anyway, is it not? Like, or, well,
it's,
I think,
well,
I think
it's... Yeah,
I think it's for people our age, you know, and in late 20s, early 30s who grew up on the 80s stuff and are now reflecting back on it. And Sean has a way of reflecting back on it that's actually pleasant to read and actually has substance and is not just like, Garbage Pail Kids rule, dude.
Yeah, I got the elevator pitch. Okay, here's the elevator pitch for it.
Okay.
It's for guys our age who are feeling nostalgic but are looking for something a little bit more substantive than satire.
There you go. Right. There's your pull quote for a blurb on your site. That eight paragraph long thing that Jersey just said. Just put that in a big blurb on your website, and traffic will just shoot up.
We'll be back on the print version.
Did you guys see Art and Story, that podcast I do with Mark Rudolph, has a website now, and so people can finally start responding to what we're doing on there. And the first comment we got was exactly what I thought we were going to get, where someone says, you know that Jersey, he talks an awful lot. Which, by the way, yeah, I know.
And I did actually listen to Art and Story, the first episode yesterday. And I have to say that I haven't been sure, why I should participate in all these podcasts and whatnot. But Jersey's always like, oh, you need to participate. You're awesome. I'm like, okay, I don't know that I'm awesome, but whatever. But, just listening to that, listening to you and Mark talk, was really interesting to me. And, just the fact that you knew what you were talking about, it was just because of your characters and whatnot, it was interesting to hear. So I am sort of put on the other side of it now, and I sort of understand how people could find my ramblings interesting if I found you and Mark's ramblings interesting.
I was talking to a photographer friend who he's a photographer. He's not a comics guy, and he's by no means a geek. He's from Britain. I mean, he's like the most dignified, quiet guy that you've ever seen in your entire life, and he was telling me how he was listening to the audio commentary that you and I did for the front, and he was like, I looked at him, I was like, I can't believe you listen to that. Why would you, of all people, listen to me and my best buddy talk about comics for an hour? And he said, well, it wasn't so much the content as it was about just listening to guys really go into their enthusiasm and geek out over something. That's what made it fascinating, was the enthusiasm is what made it interesting, not necessarily the content. He didn't come to it going like, man, I really need to know more about this comic stuff, especially the front by Jersey Droz. But he came to it and just listened to it because he knew me and found that it was actually pleasant to listen to, because it's like what I've talked about before, I think, on Art and Story, about the guy who did the interview on NPR about John Locke. And they said, thank you for your time. He said, thank you, and I love talking about John Locke. And every time I think of that, I'm like, that's what we need. Everybody should feel like that about their job.
Yeah. And I'm sure I brought this up before, but it's like people, everyone who has friends has these conversations. But what's interesting is that you don't have these conversations with people you don't know. So you're always, I think, in the back of your mind, curious, what kind of conversations are those guys having when they go off and, drink a pint at the bar?
Yeah.
And it is. When people just talk and they're into what they're talking, it's insanely interesting. It doesn't matter what they're talking about. Kevin Smith and his producer Scott Mosier have a podcast now, and they're so staying completely away from all of their movie stuff. They're just two guys talking, and I don't know. It's riveting.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Like, who was it who was doing this? I was listening to a podcast where. Oh, now I lost it.
You know why you lost it? Because you were thinking about cylindrical robots hugging.
Hundred was
no one
awesome.
Else.
Hundred was so cool. He had guns for eyes. How awesome is that?
Well, why don't you try to get the rights to Max Steel's robot for us and you bring him back?
Oh, and I would make it rule. I need to watch that cartoon again someday. I only saw part of it once when I was a little kid.
Uh-oh, eBay, here we come.
Turn that hugging feature into something really neat. Or maybe
what
it's
can
like,
be
okay,
more neat than hugging already?
Well, here's the thing. It's like the bad guys at first can't hug, and that's why they're bad, and then like they have to have a certain tip.
Oh, God.
Side of them.
You're already coming up with possibilities for story ideas.
And then at the end, they find out, I can hug. I know what love is again.
Oh, God. Wow. See, this is how you're too creative for your own good.
that's creative, I don't know about that.
If you can look at cylindrical robots hugging and come up with a backstory for it, then yeah, you might. Then it's a good thing you're in comics because you just have so much creativity.
Not really. I'd also have to figure out a reason why they have the suction cups on the bottom, too.
Oh, yeah. That's because they
maybe
can
the
stick to
the
walls because they were crazy robots.
Earthquakes.
And all you could do with them was stick them to the refrigerator. That was it. Wow, look at this. Stuck on the fridge. But the guns for ice thing was pretty darn cool.
It can hug from any angle.
It's like that Simpsons episode with the X-Files.
Everybody's hugging.
It's like the end of that Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns is the alien and he's like, I bring you love. That's what they all say all the time. Okay, so now we're getting completely nonsensical.
Yeah.
So thank you
so
guys.
So now Jersey's going to get online and find out who has the rights to Max Steel's Robot Force. And if no one has them, you're going to see them on Sugary Cereals. They're going to make a big comeback.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be some 80s properties out there that I can mine that haven't been touched. Sky Commanders is one I'd also like to get my hands on, really run with, but that's Hanna-Barbera, so I can never get that. But anyway, that's enough of that nonsense. So, we didn't talk about where people can find your thoughts.
I'm lost.
Are you?
No, if you want to find my thoughts, God help you. Right now, just go to my MySpace page at myspace.com/Hoovertron. One word, HOOVERTRON. And from there, you can be linked to the ashes of my old website, which hasn't been updated in well over a year. But that's sort of the focal point right now.
It will be updated as soon as you get your new Macintosh.
Yeah, probably not as soon as I get my new Macintosh, but eventually. But that's where I am on the interweb.
And parents, not everything Hoover says is meant for all ages.
Most of what Hoover says is not for kids.
Well,
but
no,
occasionally he starts talking about Transformers, and anyone can listen to that.
You're essentially an 8-year-old grown up.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
You use a little bit of the words that the parents find abrasive. So.
Yeah, but I don't like to use those on my MySpace page. So.
Oh, good. Well, then your MySpace page is fairly safe.
I'm not dropping bombs on my MySpace page.
Right.
It's I would say it's PG-13 at best.
Okay. Well, TV's worse than that nowadays, so I feel confident that that's not going to be a big deal. So thank you guys very much for showing up. I appreciate you taking the time to geek out with me.
Yeah.
And if any of you listeners out there enjoy this, please let these guys know so that I can convince them to come back again because I'm not paying them. And ego stroking works almost as good as money, so that's the word. Okay.
Can we end this show with a big cylindrical robot hug?
Aww. Press the button on my back, Hoover, and feel the love from my bendy straw arm.
I can see the iris dissolve now with the big hug.
And then when you least expect it, my mask flips up. And you see my gun eyes! That's the last thing you see.
Oh, man, it took a dark turn real quick.
Now you know why I like the show. Okay. So long, everybody.
Bye, kids.
Head for sugary cereals, you know I'm right behind you. Flying through the air, sugary cereals are better. Me and Boxcar know just where.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sugarycereals.com/forum. Just scroll down to where it says Saturday Supercasts. Music for this episode was provided by Umberto. You can find out more about her work at virb.com/umberto. Okay, bye.